Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Anna, and I'm here with my two friends, Will and Ant.
Hello.
Hi there.
This week, we are talking about the year 1347, one of the greats. And let's just go right into it with our three-word previews. Will?
Big Sub King.
I can tell you carefully considered those words. Okay. Ant?
Fancy dress apocalypse.
Wow. I don't really have any idea what that is.
Well, you'll find out soon.
My three words are Marco Polo.
How do you spell?
I would spell it P-F-F. F-T.
Just checks out.
There's a slight T at the end, isn't
there? Yeah, it's a slight.
Nice.
Well, great. I think everybody probably knows exactly what we're all about to talk about, but let's do it anyway. All right. Today, I'm talking about a man whose name is Shams ad-Din Abu Abdallah Muhammad ibn Abdallah ibn Muhammad ibn Ibrahim ibn Muhammad ibn Yusuf al-Lawati at-Tanji ibn Battuta.
So nice!
Yay!
Wow.
I'm going to say that every time I talk about him. No, thankfully for us and for everyone, he just went by the name
Barry.
Ibn Battuta, which actually means son of the duckling.
Oh.
Which I think is great.
Oh, wow.
Of all his names to choose from, he chose that one.
Yeah, he just loved his dad, duckling. His duckling dad. Ibn Battuta was an explorer who traveled through the entire Muslim world and beyond in a series of expeditions in the 12th century.
Was he collecting names?
He was collecting names. Everywhere he went, he got a new name. And he traveled more than any other explorer in pre-modern history. He covered 117,000 kilometers,
wow,
which absolutely blows Marco Polo out of the water.
Wow.
Anyone want to guess how many Marco Polo did?
Oh,
like 5,000 or something like that?
No.
10,000? He did it over land, didn't he? So
I think 55,000.
24,000.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Just
peanuts,
back and forth in the...
doing laps around Italy at that point. But yeah, Ibn Battuta did 117,000 kilometers. Maybe. We'll get to that part later. He was born in 1304 in Tangier in Morocco into a wealthy family of Qadis, which are Islamic legal scholars or judges. When he's 21, he decides to go on Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. But he really takes his time getting there. Yeah, he's like, I guess I'll just go elsewhere. So he does eventually make it to Mecca, but he then doesn't return to Morocco for 24 years.
Wow.
And this is the tail end of the Islamic Golden Age. So the Islamic world is massive. It stretches from Spain to Indonesia. And it essentially means that Ibn Battuta can travel freely through those lands, and he can often find work along the way as a qadi in the courts of various sultans who are ruling these territories. Obviously, it's not going to be a very fun podcast if I just spend the next 8 minutes listing countries that he went. there are many of them, but I'll give you some highlights. So one of his first stops is
Iceland.
Yes, he got really lost from Morocco to Mecca, and he ended up in Iceland. No, he goes to Alexandria, Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
And he meets two ascetic monks who tell him that his destiny as a world traveler.
Two beautiful monks.
Aesthetically
pleasing, beautiful monks.
Yes. Two aesthetically pleasing monks who tell him that he is foreordained to be a world traveler.
Remarkable.
And he is so awed by their beauty that he listens to them.
Nice.
He journeys through the Holy Land, Syria, Iran, Iraq. He goes down the east coast of Africa to Somalia. He goes to Mecca several times on Hajj. And then in 1330, he decides to go to Delhi to work for the Sultan there. But he doesn't just head straight for India. He goes through Anatolia. He meets the Sultan of the new Ottoman Empire. Mm. He buys a young Greek girl as a slave.
What?
he gets up into the Golden Horde and meets with the Mongol Khan's court. He considers going to Siberia, but is like, nope, too cold. Not going to do that. He goes back west to Constantinople to escort the Khan's pregnant wife. He meets the Byzantine emperor. He goes to Afghanistan, and then he finally crosses the Hindu Kush to make it to India 3 years later.
Like, can you imagine that, like, interview process? So when can you start?
I know.
Like, ooh, got a few errands to run
first. Yeah, I'll be there like 3 years. And I guess the Sultan's HR team is just waiting onboard him.
Okay, so was he, quote, journeying, unquote? Or was he just like working in places and living in places?
Yeah, so it depends. Some of the places he goes and he stays for a while and works. But some he just goes through. And I really think he just had wanderlust.
Yeah, but how did he get to meet so many famous people?
As he travels, the kind of legend around him grows. So by point, he's 10 or 15 years into this journey. He's started to get a reputation. He's accumulating wealth. So he's got this big retinue of, you know, slaves and other sort of people that travel with him. So by the time he gets to a new place, the leader of that place has usually heard of him.
Like,
so he goes and works in their court.
Yeah, I get that.
So he really gets around. He's doing a lot. But yeah, so he finally makes it to India. He works with a sultan in Delhi for 6 years, partly because the sultan won't actually let him leave.
Okay.
He alternately loves Ibn Battuta and accuses him of treason. Which I think are two quite extreme.
That's a toxic relationship right there.
Yes.
That, to be fair, is how I feel about both of you. But then the Sultan decides to send Ibn Battuta to China on a diplomatic mission, and he goes straight there.
Wow.
No, he doesn't.
Oh.
he goes to the Maldives. Because why wouldn't you?
I mean, he deserves a break.
He deserves a break. Yeah, he needs to kick back.
Before all the tourist infrastructure in the Maldives, it must have been quite difficult to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, I think the beauty was there from time immemorial.
Okay.
Well, the white sands.
But yeah, the white sands are not imported by the hotel chains.
Okay.
But yeah, he sort of does and doesn't have a great time in the Maldives. So he doesn't have a great time there because he's working as a qadi, as a judge, and he's trying to get the people of the Maldives to conform to his own more orthodox interpretation of Islamic law.
No beach parties in Maldives.
No beach parties.
Yeah. Minibar empty.
Minibar empty, publicly whipping people for not attending Friday prayer.
Then
in the real horrible one, forbidding women from being topless in public, which was apparently the norm on the islands at the time. So the people in the Maldives were like, thank you, but no thank you. And
free
he's basically dismissed.
Sounds like the hotel I went to last year. Two-star rating in retrospect.
Yeah, fair enough. But he does have a good time in the Maldives because he marries four different women.
Wow.
And again, he was there for 9 months.
That's incredible.
He's really just tearing through them. Across the course of his journeys, he marries like dozens of women and has children with many of them.
Yeah.
And then will just leave them and sometimes check in on them when he's passing back through that town on his way back to Morocco or whatever. But in the Maldives, apparently this was quite common. Women would have, well, first of all, they were women in the 1300s, so they had absolutely no agency, but they didn't have any sort of social mobility, but they would often have small dowries. So it was apparently pretty common practice for sailors or travelers to come to the islands, marry a woman, get her dowry, stay with her for a little while, and then leave. And I have no idea why this was beneficial to the women, but apparently that was pretty common.
Why did it perpetuate?
Yeah, I guess maybe because it gave them a little more like access to a different type of world. They could maybe leave their family homes and go live with their husbands or something. Hmm. But yeah, so Ibn Battuta in the Maldives.
I'm starting to think that women haven't had a really good time throughout history.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something
there.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Anyway, so he leaves the Maldives. He leaves all his wives behind. In 1345, he finally makes it to China. And then in 1346 or 47, he starts his journey back to Morocco. And when he finally gets there, he learns that both of his parents have died while he's been gone for 24 years.
Yeah, makes sense.
He's presumably very sad about this, but not too sad because after only a few days in Tangier, he sets out on another voyage.
Going to say he gets married again.
He probably did, honestly. Let him loose for a few days. He's taken a wife. Interestingly, at no point on any of his voyages over these decades did he keep a diary or a record or write anything down. So in 1354, when someone suggests he write a book, he dictates the whole thing by memory. And the book is eventually called A Masterpiece to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Traveling. But it is more commonly known as the Rihla, which just means like travelogue. And it turns out that maybe not everything in the Rihla is what you might call accurate.
Yeah.
And some of it is what you might call plagiarized.
Here we go.
There are striking similarities to some of Marco Polo's accounts of his own travels, which had happened a few decades earlier. And then there are passages that are pretty much lifted entirely from other travelogues. So it's almost certain that he didn't go to every place he claims to have been. But he definitely went some places. Yep. And the Rihla is, at the very least, a great account of what the world was like in the 14th century and in the courts of these various sultans and emperors. So anyway, that's just a very little bit about the voyages of Ibn Battuta, one of the greatest explorers in history, probably.
People don't journey these days.
Yeah. No.
People visit the place.
Yeah.
Because you're there so quickly.
Yeah.
You set out to go to a specific place, then you get there, and then you're there.
Also, well, it's harder to just wander, right? Because you feel like you've got to have a plan.
I also don't get, like, you know, given diplomatic missions to, to envoy to China.
Yeah, because in reality, you get on a Ryanair flight.
Yeah.
Send an email.
And then you're presumably doing the mission.
Well, and can you imagine the bureaucratic hassle that a voyage like that would take today? You'd have to get a visa for about 80 different countries. Yeah. You'd have to, like, I don't know, make sure your cell phone worked everywhere you went. It would be horrible.
Yeah. You wouldn't accrue any wealth.
You wouldn't accrue any wealth. You probably wouldn't be able to marry more than one person. So what's even the point?
What's the point?
Really?
Are we really free anymore?
I long for the days of Ibn Battuta, son of a duckling.
I'm going to talk about Stefan Dushan, also known as Dushan the Mighty.
Dushan, good name.
Also known as the douche.
No, not to his face, if you knew what was good for you.
Yeah.
So this is the guy who
You're
was
not supposed
king...
to douche your face anyway.
Good grief. This is the guy who was king of Serbia from 1331. And then later on, Dušan was Tsar or Emperor of the Serbs and Greeks until he died in 1355. And during his life, Dushan conquered a large part of Southeast Europe and became one of the most powerful monarchs anywhere in the world in the period. And his rule was basically hugely significant for the Serbs because under his rule, Serbia became the major power in the Balkans and also became an Eastern Orthodox multi-ethnic, multilingual empire that stretched all the way from the Danube in the north down to the Gulf of Corinth in the south. And it was its capital at the time, which was Skopje, which is now the capital of Northern Macedonia. So that was where it was centered. So cool. It was a hugely significant period of history for Serbia. And there's a bunch of ways in which he showed himself to be an exceptional leader, including establishing the first constitution for the Serbian Empire.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there have probably been other constitutions.
Yeah, although, I mean...
Probably not that many.
Not that many.
Yeah. Although it was like less a constitution and more just stuff he wanted to happen.
Okay. It was a wish list.
It was a rider.
Yeah.
It was his emperor
only
rider.
Only brown M&Ms.
Yeah.
And it became known as Dušan's Code, which was and it's probably the most important literary work of medieval Serbia.
Dušan's Code sounds like an arcade game from the 80s.
It does, yeah.
You know?
Really retro.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. Or a cheat code for like Mortal Kombat or something.
Oh, even. Yeah.
And generally, under his rule, Serbia reached a territorial peak and also its political, economic, cultural, just generally everything peak during his time. And then when he died in 1355, that then marked the end of the resistance to the Ottoman Empire, who had been steadily advancing, and also brought about the subsequent fall of the Eastern Orthodox Church in the region, which is all just hugely significant because it then set the scene for the way Serbia and the wider Balkans have then been this centerpiece for civilizational tussle ever since.
Yeah.
In so many different ways between the East and West and the Orthodox world and in so many different ways.
Wow.
There's also lots that's remarkable about his life and the way he lived as well. So he was heavily influenced by the Byzantines, who themselves... Byzantines?
No.
It's definitely not the Byzantines.
It's not the Byzantines. It's the Byzantines.
I say Byzantines.
Heavily influenced by the Byzantines.
How about by Byzantium?
Yeah.
Byzantium?
No.
He was heavily influenced by the Byzantines, who themselves, of course, were successors to the Romans.
Yep.
Or basically were Romans in many ways. And he deliberately tried to emulate them. So as a result, he was the first Serbian monarch who wrote most of his letters in Greek.
Oh, okay.
And also signed with imperial red ink, which carried on for a while afterwards. And then he was also the first to publish Prostagma, which is a kind of...
Excuse me?
Prostagma. Prostagma. Okay. Potentially pro-stagma,
maybe. Well, you don't want to be anti-stagma. actually, clarify what it is,
Is stagma?
Before I die on
Well, it's
this
a
film.
Kind of Byzantine document, which was, again, a characteristic thing that Byzantine rulers had.
All right.
And in his royal title, which was the Emperor of the Serbs and Greeks, he was trying to claim to be the successor to the Eastern Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And if that wasn't enough, he also gave Byzantine court titles to his nobility, which then continued until about the 16th century. So like lots of rulers before and after, he was trying to, you know, create this link with the Romans as a way of propping up his own authority and legitimacy.
Man, people really do love claiming descent from the Romans to prop up their own legacies.
Which brings me to my next point of how I claim descent from the Romans and the Greeks myself.
Yeah.
So
you
were
a concubine, weren't you?
I was a concubine,
at Caesar's Palace.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
That was in LA, though.
And contemporary writers describe Dušan as unusually tall and strong.
Love that.
And try to control yourself.
Well, he's no Robert Guiscard.
Yeah, I know how taken you are with tyrannical medieval figures.
Can't get enough of them.
But they describe him as, quote, the tallest man of his time, unquote.
Wow. Love it.
Very handsome and a rare leader full of dynamism, quick intelligence and strength, bearing a kingly presence.
Wow. That's pretty good.
It's great.
Yeah.
And according to contemporary depictions, he had dark hair and brown eyes. And in adult age, he grew a full beard and even longer hair.
Wow, really painting
so
a
descriptive,
vivid picture.
That historian would not be a good Mills and Boone writer.
He had long hair and then later had slightly longer hair until he got it cut and it was shorter.
Some of the supposed historians.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From this period are no better than us.
Their podcasts were shit.
He had some amazing titles. So he was first crowned young king when he was heir apparent on the 6th of January 1322, but he was too young to really rule with his father at that point. And then he was given the province of Zeta later on, so he became king of Zeta, which is quite cool. And then in 1331, he succeeded his father as king of all Serbian and maritime lands.
Ooh.
Maritime lands.
Maritime lands.
Like, is that like subaquatic, like the actual ocean floor? Or is that like islands?
No, that's subaquatic ocean floor.
So okay, yeah, good.
He was the king of the seabed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And his,
what was Ariel's father called?
King Triton.
Yeah.
So yeah. He was
Triton,
the king of...
took over from him.
Yeah.
I think in the 1380s.
That's right. And then, then Triton was king of all maritime seafloors and crustaceans.
That's correct.
And their orchestras.
And then in 1346, he was crowned Emperor of the Serbs and Greeks. And this title was soon enlarged into Emperor and Autocrat of the Serbs and Greeks and Bulgarians and Albanians.
Wow.
Do they know this as well? And do they agree to it?
Who, the Bulgarians and Albanians?
Yeah.
I think they knew about it.
What about the subaquatic Bulgarians? Were they part of this as well?
Well, as in like lobsters who identify as Bulgarian.
Yeah, sure.
I think they were included in the maritime lands.
That was that was a rebellion later on in his reign, I think. The Bulgarian lobster rebellion.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's not talk about it here because we might get it in a different year.
So many nipped fingers.
A lot of pincer movements.
Oh, yes. God.
Hey. So there you go. Unsurprisingly, given he was the guy who took the Serbian Empire to its absolute height, he remains a total folk hero in Serbia. Yeah. And there are, for instance, in lots of like strategy games, you can play his campaigns and things if you're Serbian. And he remains just this massive historical figure for them. There you go.
Dushan
the Mighty.
Dushan the Mighty.
It's pretty good.
I like him.
Cool dude.
Cool. So for my lesson today, children.
Oh, God.
We shall be discussing Italy.
Oh, what a new topic for you, Ant.
For a change. but specifically, I am not going to steer anywhere close to the Medicis or any of that kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk about a chap called Cola di Rienzo.
Mm.
So Cola was an Italian kind of revolutionary of sorts. He was a populist and a nationalist. He's a very interesting figure that sort of combines sort of political intrigue with sort of allegory and populism and sort of prophecy of doomsday and like pageantry as well as his gifts for oratory to sort of whip up public discourse and change the course of politics in Rome.
Hmm.
So it was a very turbulent time in Europe at the time, especially for Rome, who were on the descendancy, because this was during what was called the Avignon Papacy.
Oh, yes. The Great Schism.
Correct. Or the Babylonian Captivity.
Yes.
Where the Pope had actually left Rome. Yeah. It was ensconced in Avignon in France. And it's about 70 years period where the popes there were selected and controlled by the French kings, which meant that, well, Rome was on a descendancy. They lost a lot of that sweet, sweet pilgrim economy.
Yeah.
Wasn't flooding in.
But all the communion wine was Cabernet now.
Exactly. Yeah, it just wasn't the same.
Yeah.
And the Holy Roman Empire was also, there's separate claimants, there's a lot of sort of schisms. There was also the sort of, the divide between the Guelphs and the, Ghiblians, which was...
sorry, did you say elves and goblins?
Elves and goblins. The Guelphs and Ghiblians, which was the divide of like pro-papists and secular empire.
No, no.
This is true?
No,
this
is true. No, no, no.
I'm losing
no.
my mind at so the Guelphs and the Ghiblians.
The Guelphs and the Ghiblians were the two Italian sides. One were pro-papacy.
Well, these are Italian words.
Yes, yeah. The papist Guelphs and the secular... Ghiblians.
Oh my God.
Anyway, we're getting completely off track here, okay? They don't feature any
further. What's the track?
The track is Rome. There's lots of unrest and rifts throughout Christendom. Rome is very much on the down. Right. And Cola comes into our story here. He was born of very humble origins. He was the son of an innkeeper and a washerwoman in a very bad part of town in Rome. But he did receive a liberal education. Which doesn't mean nowadays liberal education, which is like, you know.
Yeah.
And is this the story of how he defeated his arch nemesis, Pepsi?
His secret blend of flavors. No, he didn't receive any sort of knowledge on how to make fizzy beverages, but he did learn Greek and Latin, and he was able to practice speaking in public quite a lot to increase his oratory ability, and he became a notary, and therefore was, you know... Yeah, exactly. He was
real power.
You know, he gained and gathered a bit of power there in sort of the bureaucracy of Rome, and so wasn't so lowly stationed. But he did have a flair for the dramatic, and the style of his writings and the style of his speech. And he also was a bit obsessed that the end of times was coming and that Christianity was, you know, Rome was falling, and therefore like this is very prophetic, and you know, people should rise up, etc.
People are very quick to call end of times, aren't they?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
I mean, they're
well, they're right though.
Yeah, time has been ending since it began. If you really think about it.
Wow, so deep. So, if you finished ripping on your bong,
it helps me podcast.
Yeah. So during this time of decline in Rome, poverty and infighting had happened because, you know, the scarce of the resources, the barons and the oligarchs were fighting their street-to-street battles, and some of them were often barricaded to stop the, you know, quarrelling and stuff spilling into the streets. And Cola was rising in the sort of bureaucracy, and he went to Avignon as part of a delegation. Because what had happened is there was a change in sort of political leadership inside Rome from where the barons were directly controlling to a newly set up quote unquote 13 good men, which were chosen by the barons, so it's basically the same thing.
That's a sequel to 12 angry men.
Exactly, 13 good men. As an excellent speaker, he gets to meet the Pope, and he actually tries to persuade this French Pope to come back to Rome. He gains friends but also enemies by decreeing the sort of baronocracy that's happening and the oligarchs and so on. And they try to discredit him, but the Pope actually quite likes him, so he has the Pope's favour, and that carries a lot of weight, and therefore he can't just be completely ousted from society.
Yeah.
Hang on, then where's the Pope right now? The
Pope's in Avignon.
Okay.
So he comes back without a Pope to come back to Rome. Pope stays there. But what he does is he goes on a mission then to bring back what he thinks is the Imperial Republic of Rome.
Oh!
And he does this in a sort of a very flamboyant way. If you look at any sort of inscriptions or drawings or paintings of them, he's always wearing these flamboyant capes and hats or like full suits of armor. It was a bit out of place.
Just walking around in a full suit of armor.
Yeah, like honestly, he was like, he dressed in fancy capes and vestments, and he made like, he painted large allegorical murals on buildings as sort of propaganda pieces.
Well, he himself
I'm sure he probably had people that painted
so
for
he
him.
Was Banksy.
Yeah,
proto-Banksy.
And like they were like, you know, very much on the nose of like the goddess of truth crying in the river kind of thing, and this is like, you know, the mourning at the loss of all this kind of stuff. But you know, the barons hated it, but the you know, the peasants, the regular people.
Yeah. Imagine if you did that today, that would just bring down society.
Oh yeah. Like, if I painted a picture of a woman crying in a river. Oof, World War III.
The barons are getting quite annoyed at him now, but he's popular, and the people use him as a focal point of this like romantic populist ideal of a Roman Empire, and he's gathered a lot of allies. And then on May 20th in 1347, Cola, dressed flamboyantly again as a knight in full armour, leads an armed procession to the Senate and declared a new republic, which caused the barons to up and flee. And then he took the title of Roman Tribune for himself.
Nice.
A title which I assume had lapsed completely hundreds
and,
of years
and
ago.
And this is the whole shtick, right? Like he sort of whipped up that sort of populist ideal, that sort of romantic idea of the Roman, ancient Roman Empire to bring it back together and that they could build this sort of thing again and that it was part of their DNA and stuff. Yeah. So he used that sort of imagery along with sort of modern ideals together.
And Dushan was doing the same thing at the same time. Who's a Roman to believe?
Yeah, no, there's so many Romans everywhere.
Yeah.
But so the Roman Tribune, which was an ancient title, it's an elected official, or it also could mean spiritual man. And he mixed this ancient Roman and sort of Catholic ideals to take back the power.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's kind of an interesting sort of political approach to how you sort of stir the masses to your to your political ends. And so Cola really saw himself as ushering in a new age of restoring Rome. And he sent out letters across Italy into the Pope saying, you know, the new Rome is established. And that he had this really interesting argument to make where it wasn't just that God chose kings or emperors to rule. He also believed that God could choose the people to rule as well.
Mm.
That by enacting this form of rule from the populism, that the people in, you know, it's a sort of proto-democracy, I guess, you know, it is de facto a legitimate form of ruling. The Pope hated this.
Many people hated this.
But his love of pageantry kept on going and he kept getting a bit more grand. He knighted himself. He bathed in the baptistry of the lantern, or the Lateran, which is the papal sort of baptismal font in Rome. And he went on to claim Rome as a sovereign state. This wrinkled a lot of people the wrong way. And it could be interpreted, probably quite rightly, as wresting Rome from Pope Clement in Avignon.
Well, to be fair, if Clement wanted Rome, he should have been in Rome.
Yeah, fair.
You know what I mean?
True, true.
I'm team Cola here.
In it to win it. So he was losing fans in Avignon, and he was kind of seen as an usurper and heretic. And the barons were also gathering power against this guy, and they mounted an attack. But Cola defeated them soundly because the people had all raised up against them. And he took a lot of barons prisoner. A lot of them were killed as well. But Pope Clement interjected. He threatened Cola with excommunication, not just for him, but for the entire city of Rome.
Oh,
so
my God.
The Pope, one of the powers a Pope has, if you believe in this sort of thing, is to place a city under an interdict, which is effectively a mass excommunication.
Wow.
And so the Pope threatened this. And that was not going to fly with the locals.
Yeah.
And Cola knew that this was over. The Pope had pulled a trump card. And so he had no choice. He fled. He was effectively excommunicated and on the run. And this is when the Black Plague struck. So he had incorporated into his sort of shtick and his spiels about like the end of times is coming and the new world order and that kind of stuff. Maybe not exactly those words,
but still.
He saw the Black Plague as a...
pestilence.
Yeah, he saw this as an absolute sign. Rome had fallen from him. The Black Plague has struck. This is God speaking to him. He thought that he could get to the Holy Roman Empire and maybe he could get them on their side instead, on his side. So he introduced himself. He traveled for ages to get there and he introduced himself as a visionary. He said he was a visionary. I prophesize this Black Plague that's happening. And he also claimed that his mother was actually made pregnant, not by his father, but by the previous Holy Roman Empire, which would make Cola Emperor Charles's uncle. So he went along and said, "Hi, I'm a visionary and your uncle, by the way." Unfortunately, the emperor did actually like him because he's a fantastic speaker, great company, bit of a laugh, lad, a bit of a lad on the booze as well, great fun. But he didn't want to rock the boat, you know, the delicate power balance. And so he didn't, you know, get in his side and sort of against the Pope. And eventually the Pope in Avignon asked Emperor Charles, please send him to face charges of heresy. And so Emperor Charles, he had to do it, but he took him a couple of years to do it. He, you know, he didn't want to send him straight away.
He didn't want to get rid of his buddy.
He did send him across to Avignon in the end. But at this stage, Pope Clement had actually died. And therefore, there was no trial for heresy. And Cola sort of, you know, went down on his knees and said, please forgive me. You know, I'm just doing what I thought was right. And Pope Innocent now thought that he could actually use Cola to counter the brewing unrest that's still happening in Rome with the barons and all this kind of like weird fancy ideals that Cola had left behind, including from one of his followers who is now sort of taking charge.
Yeah.
And the Pope Innocent actually confirmed his status as a knight and appointed him an official senator in Rome. So what he had seized power beforehand and given himself, the Pope had then invested in him as well. And he went there to Rome to sort of work on behalf of Pope Innocent. And he gathered the barons and said, right, this is the way things are going to be. This is the new thing. I'm in charge on behalf of the Pope. The barons also hated this.
The barons. They can't be pleased.
They were not happy. They would not swear fealty to the new government. They once again rebelled. And so Cola took to the streets to gather the one thing that he had on his side, the people. And so standing probably in a fancy cape and a hat, he stood on a barrel and was like, gathered the people, and they immediately started booing and jeering him.
Well, I was going to say, because aren't they still mad at him for getting them all excommunicated?
Yeah, they're so mad at him. Yeah. They nearly got excommunicated.
Read the room, dude.
And like he had lost all his power with the people whatsoever because he fled and he didn't bring anything, and life just got worse for them. And they had enough of his shtick, and they turned on him. So he had to flee from rallying the troops. He dressed himself as a pauper, but was soon discovered when his rich robes underneath were spotted flapping underneath into the robe or whatever. He was seized upon by the people and killed by an angry mob. He was then hung upside down outside the church of San Marcello for 2 weeks and then was burned ceremonially in a location that was normally used for like empire pyres in the day in Italy. So it was very sort of poignant, fitting.
Man, back in the day, they really knew how to kill people.
Yeah.
I mean, kill them and then keep killing them and then do just horrific things to them after they're dead.
Yeah. And so Cola, he's a fascinating man. The way he sort of came about power, he wove ancient allegory, doomsday prophecies, and tapped into sort of that spiritual identity of Italy. He was ultimately unsuccessful, but he's still to this day, inspires Italian nationalists and has gone on for years after his death.
He really made a big mistake going back that final time, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
He could have just settled down
he
and become.
He should have just stayed with
his consultant
nephew,
or an accountant.
Could have done anything. Yeah, he could have been like a high school drama teacher. I think he would have been well fit for that.
Yeah, it's worth looking him up, though, because the pictures of him, he's always in this crowd of people just wearing normal clothes and he's wearing something completely flamboyant and unnecessary.
You know what's crazy? If he existed now, he would probably be running for president of the United States and he'd probably do quite well.
Yeah, well, especially if he had the Pope in his sight.
Yeah, such a demagogue.
He's got a flair for the theatric, hasn't he?
Oh, Cola, what a man.
There you go, 1347.
Thanks for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1347.
Mm-hmm. So, Will, can you please boot up the random number generator?
Of course. It is getting to its operating temperature, and the next year for next week will be the year 244.
244. We've been close to that. We had 261.
Do you want to know a secret?
Yeah. Yep.
The year 244 is my favorite year.
Wow. What will you be discussing, Will? Which of your favorite topics?
There's so much I could discuss.
The only thing that's happening now is Rome. I'm going to be doing Rome 3 episodes in a row, I think, which I'm okay with.
That's because you're on the Medici's payroll now, so you just have to talk about Italy.
Look, everyone's got a price.
I'm not supposed to say that out loud.
Everyone's got their price.
Okay, 244. Yeah, there will be Rome. There are other things.
Can we just apply to the council to change the rules to be like from 1950 to 2000 instead? Like, just do that. I think
you know this is our podcast.
Yeah, no, but we report to the council, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the board?
The board, yeah.
Not like the local council.
Not the local.
This isn't like a public service.
Isn't it?
It's opposite. It's almost a public disservice.
It's a public disservice. That is definitely true. A-level results are right down across the country.
Well, if the mayor wants to actually sponsor us, that's fine.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah, we've made entreaties to the mayor of Hull. So anyone else, we're listening. Okay, cool. Well, 244, it's going to be great. We will see you then.
Bye.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.